Guides Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The Chugach Mountains behind Anchorage might be as familiar as your bedroom wall, but they're still big, rugged peaks with plenty of hard miles in them. My guests today have done those miles. I have two mountain runners who have completed the 12-peak challenge in the Chugach. This is an incredible ultra-marathon that links a dozen summits in the Front Range on a single, very long day. To complete it is an extraordinary accomplishment and will just about kill the toughest runners. But now, athletes are finding ways to do it faster. We'll hear about the challenge and the adventures it has created in two interviews on today's show. We're sticking with the Chugach for long treks and local mountain running for the rest of the show, too. We'll hear a trail tale about Crow Pass Trail and in Indy, Alaska, about mountain running. At the end of today's show, stay tuned for a second trail tale by former Governor and Mayor Tony Knowles. He talked about his work creating trails in Anchorage and his dreams for what comes next. It's All Trails and Mountain Running on Outdoor Explorer. Stick with us. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guest right now is J.T. Lindholm, who is a runner, lives out in the Eagle River Valley, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Right up on the mountains there.
Yeah.
And if you got mountains around, then you run in them, right? And so I'm just guessing that the mountains are probably one of your favorite places to run because of what we're talking about today, which is this 12-peak run that you did, this connection of different peaks. How did you ever decide to do that? And, well, let's start with, like, what is it? It's 12 peaks through the Chugach, linking them together. How many miles, do you know?
Sure, yeah, it's roughly, depending on your route, the 12 peaks equate to around 40-ish miles.
Wow.
With about 20,000 vert in general.
So that's like an incredible challenge,
You know, it is. It is when you view it just kind of as a single event. You know, as anyone can tell you, when you sort of take on something like this, whether it's a 12-peak challenge or some ultra race, or, you know, perhaps for you it's even just running a 5K or a 10K, what starts out seeming crazy sort of becomes normal, you know, or mm-hmm. something within kind of the realm of the possibilities. And then it's just a matter of seeing whether or not
gutting it out.
Yeah, right? Seeing whether or not you've got it, whether your limits, you know, can handle that.
And you did this solo, right?
I did it solo. I did do it solo, yeah.
Was that a decision, or just you couldn't find anybody else crazy enough to do it?
Probably a little bit of both. The logistics certainly were a lot easier just as a solo runner.
Yeah. Yep. So what is it? I don't know if you remember the name of the peaks in the sequence, or where do you start out at?
Sure. So, and again, you know, this is just sort of a string of 12 peaks, and the person who first kind of got me excited about it was Rob DeVellis, and his concept was to try to start at sea level and finish at sea level, and so he started at the Snowhawk Valley trailhead, kind of on the northeast end of town, and started at Temptation Peak, and then ended coming out on Turnagain Arm.
Oh, wow.
So that he could finish, like I said, finish at sea level.
Uh-huh.
I chose to start up high and finish low. So I started up at the Rabbit Lakes Trailhead, kind of on the backside of Flat Top there.
But the same sequence of peaks?
The same sequence of peaks in the other order.
I got you.
So I ended with the peak that Rob DeVellis started with. So I started on with the Suicides, and then kind of traversed over to
kind of covering the whole park.
Well,
at least the front half of
the front, yeah, sort of the part of the park that faces Anchorage.
You're all used to, yeah.
It's a big park. It's a 500,000-acre park. So
to what extent do you have to just go on tundra without a pathway, or is there a pathway the whole distance?
There's definitely not a path the whole distance. I'm not exactly sure I could give you percentages, but mm-hmm. almost all of it is just connecting ridge lines. If, you know, again, for the most part, if there is a pathway, it's going to be made by goats and sheep, and things like that. Not so much human formed or human maintained.
Was a lot of this new ground for you, or was it mostly just putting together places you'd already been to?
You know, and that's one of the things that really made it so special for me, is that it really sort of brought together, you know, years, a decade or so of just kind of romping around in the Chugach. All of the peaks I had climbed individually before, all of them multiple times, actually. But it was just this opportunity to sort of link up, you know, kind of all those peaks and all those experiences. There was still a lot of new ground for me to cover between the peaks. There was a lot of the link-ups that I had never done before. And got very lucky on.
I would think that you'd end up like crashing through some brush and like through some rivers and all that stuff.
Yeah, thankfully most of it, you know, you're on ridge lines, and so most of it, I didn't have to deal with much brush at all. But certainly some exposure, certainly some of that wonderful Chugach crud that's out there to scramble around on.
Yeah.
The times when there was brush, luckily there was a trail there for me. Yeah.
So what was the hardest part of this? Was it just being out there for so long?
Yeah, I think, you know, as with most experiences like this, the hardest part is going to be mental. You know, my body was ready for it, but it's a matter of kind of convincing yourself that you can complete it, that you can link all these little dots on the horizon up. You know, as far as the day is concerned, right around the middle of the trip, somewhere around O'Malley Peak, I definitely started hitting a low, kind of having some self-doubt. But then, you know, just a quick little sit down, rehydrating, you know, getting some nutrition in you, and then heading back off again.
Fast hiking or really running?
If it was, you know, I'm going to say flat, but if it was relatively flat, I was definitely, you know, jogging or running.
You'd almost have to cover that much distance in that amount of time.
If you're shooting for getting it done under a day, you're going to need to put some speed on for sure.
The other thing that strikes me is, number one, you just got to be eating a ton of food and carrying a ton of water, because there's not water necessarily everywhere out there. Right.
Yeah. Water is definitely one of the biggest challenges on that link up, is really kind of knowing your water sources along the route. And then, you know, a couple times I had to actually come down off the what I'll call the route, but off the ridge line to dip down into a river valley or down to a tundra pond to kind of fill back up again.
Yeah. And what do you do for food when you're on a long run like that?
You know, I think everybody has their own strategies. Yeah. For some people, it's, you know, marshmallows and salami.
That's not gonna work.
Exactly. And that's not my plan. I tend to try to eat as much as possible real food. And so I had, you know, roll-ups and a sweet potato, and then an assortment of bars and gels to sort of get me over some of the sugar lows.
How did you train to do this? Is it just your normal, like, running up and down the hills around your house, or how do you get ready for something that length?
Yeah, again, I'm lucky in that at that time in my life, I still am a teacher, and I was a teacher then, and I was not working during the summers. So I didn't have any children at the time. So I was able to sort of take my summers and be a little selfish with them, and you know, make kind of training my priority. So I was able to rest well and eat well, and really kind of focus my life around training for something like this. You know, I think I need to share that this was not my first attempt at it.
Oh, really?
When
okay.
I actually did it, I had actually planned on doing it the two summers prior, and so I'd been thinking about it for a while.
What happened the first time?
Honestly, the weather. I should say weather the summer before, and then two summers before that, I was supposed to have joined Rob DeVellis, who was someone else, one of the earlier completers of this link up. I was planning on joining Rob DeVellis and a group of runners doing it. I think it was in 2005 or 2006, and I'd been on a raft trip in Idaho with my dad. My plane was to come in the day before, and got delayed. And so
instead of just missed it.
Instead of coming in at 10 p.m., I got in at 3 a.m., and I could not physically get from the airport to my house and then to the trailhead in time. You know, yes
so you,
and no.
So you ended up doing it on your own. And
right.
So you mentioned that you got about halfway through and you started to have a have a sinker, you know, you're starting to feel like, oh, maybe this isn't such a great idea. Tell us what happened next.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, from that point, it's just a matter of pulling on past experiences, you know, saying like, I know where I am. I know what I've got to do. I know what's ahead. And, you know, quite honestly, when you're in the middle of this thing, it's not like you can just...
You don't have a choice, right?
Right. You're not going to haul off to the locker room, you know, and take a shower. You know, you still, you know, your choices are to either continue forward, which is a long way, or, you know, return to a trailhead, which is still a pretty long way.
Right,
so,
right. You might as well go forward.
You might as well go forward. You might as well go forward, yeah. And I didn't feel like I was being unsafe. It was more, again, just sort of a mental low point.
You get a second wind?
In that event, there was a second wind, a third wind, probably on into the double-digit winds. Yeah.
So how long did it actually take, the whole thing?
I am not a number. I'm a math teacher, but I'm not a numbers guy. It was in the 22-hour range. Unfortunately, I can't recite for you.
But summertime, the sun's always up, so.
Yeah, the date that I did it was July 1st and 2nd. I do remember that, those numbers. Mm-hmm. Daylight was definitely not an issue for me. It was a clear night, and in fact, it was cold enough that when I went to go get water early in the morning, I actually had to break through some ice on one of the little tundra ponds.
Wow.
So even in July, it was freezing up there.
So, were you wrecked when you were done? I'm sure you're feeling great that you did it, but you must have just been absolutely wrecked.
Oh, it's, you know, that's almost a hysterical story. And I really do hope that you get the opportunity to talk with Harlow about this, because his experience was completely different than mine. My memory of Harlow's experience is that when he finished, something like 2 weeks later, he went down to the Grand Canyon in Utah and did a rim to rim to rim, which is another 40-mile
crazy
ultra. I got done with that with my attempt, with my completion of this this event, and I don't think I felt like running for over a month. I was wrecked. I really do consider this to be the most difficult thing that I've ever done physically in my life.
I can well imagine.
Yeah.
I mean,
sorry, I hope I'm not talking anybody out of this. No, it's really a tremendous experience. I was just
that
knackered.
That much vertical climb and that number of hours is just, your body's not meant for that.
I don't know if it's not meant for it, but it certainly took its toll.
Yeah,
took its toll.
So once is enough.
Yeah. Never say never. You know, it's a beautiful link up, and it really does. As I was traveling through the country and going from peak to peak, I was really able to kind of reflect back on, you know, the other times I had been on that summit and who I had been with and where they are now and where I am now. So it really was... It may sound a little hokey, but you know, it's kind of just a little walk down memory lane as I kind of traipse through the backcountry there.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming in, JT.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, JT Lindholm, talked about the 12th Peak run in the Chugach, and we're going to stay on that topic. So stay with us here on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We'll have another runner who completed the 12 Peak Challenge in a few minutes, but first I have a story for you about young people backpacking the Crow Pass Trail for the first time. It's the historic Iditarod Trail section that runs through the Chugach from Girdwood to Eagle River. This story by Aubrey Smith was told at the Trail Tales event put on by Alaska Trails in front of a live audience.
I feel a little dressed down coming in here, but then I realized, like, I have my belt buckle on, so I'm actually, like, dressed up a notch, right? Okay. Plus, I'm from Talkeetna, so I get a pass, right? My parents made it up to Seward, Alaska from San Antonio, Texas, looking for a change, and they got that change. They got here in the late fall. And that first winter they were here was so snowy and so cold. My mom says that her favorite flower is still the dandelion, because that is the first sign of color she saw after 10 long months. So she loves the dandelion still. But anyways, they actually embraced the Alaska culture. They learned how to ski. They learned when it finally did, the snow did melt. They learned how to hike and bike and kayak and camp and fish. And I was born a year later, And I was lucky enough to be born in Seward, right on Resurrection Bay, with the mountains surrounding me, the glaciers surrounding me. And my parents were both teachers, and so all summer long, we would hike and camp and just play in the mountains, and I thought this was like a great lifestyle, right? Until I was a teenager. And that was when my parents realized they were going to have to like recruit a bunch of my friends to go on these trips with us, because otherwise I would just be sullen and sulk the whole time. And so one of my best friends, her name was Andrea Previs, and her family didn't do these kind of trips, so she was really excited to go with us. And she became a regular on all of our camping trips, so much so she really got into it. And her plan for herself and myself, before our senior year, she said, you know, we need to do our own like overnight trip. No sisters, no brothers, no parents, just you and I. You know, this is to prove, you know, that we are independent. We're going off to college. We are becoming adults now. We can get this freedom. You know, we're old enough where our parents really don't have to nag us all that much. And so this was her idea of like proving to everybody like we were big enough and old enough to do this by ourselves. And she really wanted to do Crow Pass. So I have something in common with Jeff here. My story is about Crow Pass. So she wanted to do Crow Pass, which I had done with my parents when I was younger, but it had been a long time. And so Crow Pass is like a 24-mile trail up into the mountains, you know, down along glaciers, and of course the big terrain features, this big river that you have to cross. And when I had done it with my parents, it was a four-day trip. We did it very slowly. And so Andrea and I were like super motivated. We were like, we're going to do it in 2 days. We can do this, right? And my parents were like, great, sounds like a great idea. And so we're like, sweet. We were so excited about packing, and we had these checklists, and we practiced packing our bags really nicely. We practiced setting up the tent. We had to practice turning on the cook stove. For some reason, that was really tough. It was one of those little, I don't know what it was called, but they were very hard to turn on. I don't know. So we had to practice that a lot and cook your own meals. And we practiced and practiced, and finally the day came when we could do this trip, and we were so excited. And my mom was going to drop us off in Girdwood, pick us up 2 days later at Eagle River. This was the time before cell phones. So we were just, you know, she was going to pick us up sometime on that second day. And either she would have to wait, we would have to wait, whatever. The time before cell phones, everybody was very patient. There's not so much like a specific timeline, right? So she dropped us off, and we were so psyched. We were so psyched. And we started hiking really fast. And my friend Andrea is really hyper-motivated. And she wouldn't even let me stop to eat snacks. I mean, she was like taskmaster. We were on this trip. We were going. We had something to prove, right? So we start hiking really hard. And I remember the one time we stopped to take a break, there was this big rock with a hole in it. And we thought that was so cool, we stopped to take our picture next to that. But that was the only time we stopped. And we kept hiking, hiking. So that day we made it actually past the river. We crossed the river. And by the time we crossed this huge river, it's deep, it's cold, it's wide. By the time we got past that and set up our tent on the other side and made our dinner, we were feeling like the biggest badasses on earth. We were like, we have done this. We have made it. We are badass Alaskan women now. I mean, we've proved it to everybody. This is amazing. And we were exhausted that night, and we crawled in our tents, but we were so, so happy. And we woke up the next morning so sore, barely felt our hips, you know, could barely put our backpacks back on, but we were still giddy with excitement for the next day and thinking that we were going to, you know, make it to Eagle River, and everybody's going to be so proud of us, and we would have a tale to tell. And so we started hiking so happy, so happy. And the trail gets a little fuzzy after the river, and so you have to really, like, a couple times we had to stop and be like, okay, nope, we have to go back and get back on it. And we were so excited. This was actually fun, like, right? We were jumping across logs and tiptoeing our way around things, and this was just so fun. And then an hour later, we got to a second river, a big river crossing. Uh-huh. I was so excited, and we were still jabbering, and like, we were so excited about having to prove ourselves a second time across the second river. It did not occur to me that, you know, the day before, the river was flowing this way. oh, today it's flowing this way. It's exciting. It's a whole new thing. So here we go. We're plunging in. We're doing this. We're linking arms. We've done this before, so we are getting good at this, you know? So we make it to the other side. Pat ourselves on the back again. Go, go, go. Okay? And count down the miles. And we're hiking. We start hiking up this other glacial moraine, this little hill. And I thought, oh, this is, it's so weird. This is like the strongest sense of deja vu I have ever felt. But do you think that anything different occurred to me? No, I was still very clueless. So we're just hiking along, so excited. So this next part I'm going to tell is actually the most embarrassing part. And I know if Andrea heard me tell this, she'd be like, why did you have to include that? Well, because this is real trail tales, right? I have to be honest. I don't want to be. So we stop for lunch, and this French couple come on by, and they have really thick accents, and they're so excited about hiking, and they stop to talk to us. We can barely understand what they're saying, but they get out the map, and they talk excitedly, and we're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And they go off, and Andrea turns to me, and she's like, those tourists were so messed up. And I was like, yeah. And I said, yeah, they totally had their map turned upside down. So the next thing I remember is cresting this little hill, and we were still in hugely good spirits. I mean, we were freaking clueless. We were still so excited about ourselves and our power and our freedom and our independence. And cresting this hill, and we both stopped at the same time with the same high-powered shriek, because there was the rock with the hole in it. And we hung our heads, and we hiked the not very many miles back to the Girdwood side of the trailhead. And somehow we found our way home, and we would have liked to not tell anybody about this and kept it a total secret from everyone. Only my mother, remember, was back on the Eagle River side waiting for us and pissed because she didn't know where we were, and she was waiting all day. And finally, as she was pacing back and forth, she saw this sign on one of the outside doors from a ranger that said, Kay Smith, your daughter and her friend has made it back to Seward. And she thought, those little, they actually got a ride. They got here early. They got a ride back on their own, and they didn't tell me. And so she was pissed, and she got home, and we had to actually admit to her, no, we really didn't make it. And she then thought that this was so hilarious that she told as many people as she could, and we have not been able to live this down to this day. And I constantly get reminded about this anytime I do anything wrong. It's always Crow Pass. So Andrea and I, every time we talk, we consider, you know, she lives in California now, and so we don't get to see each other very much, but we've always wanted to redo the Crow Pass to get a little bit of redemption. We still haven't gotten to do that, but I still get so excited when I go out into the mountains, and I still love mostly every trail I do, even the ones with true river crossings. So thank you.
That was Aubrey Smith at Trail Tales, the event put on by Alaska Trails. Learn more about the event and their work through our site at outdoorexplorer.org.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, with me right now, I have a guest who we have had a number of times before because he tells a good story and he does a lot of great work in the community. Harlow Robinson is the founder of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame, which is a really cool organization recognizing some of our great Alaskan athletes who are so unique, and also Healthy Futures, which is getting teens out to be active, which is also a super thing that we're really focused on the show. But the reason I invited Harlow in today is because he is a great athlete in his own right, and he's done this 12 Peak Challenge. What do you call it exactly, Harlow? Do you have a name for it?
I call it exactly that, the 12 Peak Challenge, but it's called been called other things.
Peak to peak link up and
The Front Range link up. JT Lindholm tagged it the cosmic integration.
So how did you hear about this and how did you decide to do it?
Well, Sean Lyons deserves all the credit for creating the idea and doing it first. And so I guess if you do it first, you get the rights on creating a challenge. And that's what he did. And I think back in the early 90s, 93, 94, somewhere around there, he thought that would be cool to link up the 12 5,000 footers in the Front Range of the Chugach Mountains and in one effort. And so he did. And of course, Sean Lyons is a renowned outdoor writer and adventurer. And he wrote a really nice piece on his experience.
And that got everybody else wanting to do it.
Right. It was interestingly enough, it was written and kind of forgotten. And like I said, I think that was back in the early 90s. And he kind of went in the archives. And it wasn't until, I think, sometime in the early, mid-2000s, the aughts, I ran into Trond Jensen and Joe Stock at some function. And they said, hey, we found this old article by Sean Lyons in the paper. And we thought that would be a really cool thing to try to do. And then, of course, other people like myself dug up that initial story by Sean, and we all got kind of intrigued by this idea. And Sean, you know, I should say what he did specifically was, leave from a trailhead, unsupported. And
he was solo?
And he summited the 12 peaks and then finished at a different trailhead, chose his own route.
That's kind of the classic example.
And by doing so, he established kind of the ground rules that everyone else that has come along after has followed in that you have to be self-supported and that your time, if that's important to you, starts when you leave the trailhead and it finishes when you return
trailhead. Yeah, that's some legit sort of parameters there.
Right.
So is this you are obviously keeping track of Alaska's greatest athletes and you're totally in this world.
Right.
I mean, this is like the ultimate local mountain running challenge for sure. And I would say an ultimate fitness challenge as well. Would you regard it that way?
Sure. I mean, there are different skills and expertise within mountain running. I mean, for example, there are some guys that just destroy Mount Marathon and their lungs are, their cardiovascular aerobic ability is through the roof, but they may not have that endurance level to go out and sustain effort for close to 24 hours. So
it's basically a mountain running ultra marathon.
An ultra challenge. So I wouldn't say it's the singular challenge for mountain runners, but it definitely is the spirit of, I think most of us that are into mountain running in that scene do it because we like to get out in the mountains for not just a quick up and down on flat top, but to get out there and really immerse yourself. So
how would you compare this to Crow Pass?
It's really not very comparable. Crow Pass is primarily in below the tree line or around the tree line, and it's quite a bit of running while on a technical trail. But
it's steep at the beginning if you start from the Girdwood side, but then it's not all that. It's pretty
flat. You do get up and over a pass at the beginning, but total vertical is, I think for the Crow Pass trail is around 4,000 feet, and where no matter what route you pick in the 12 peaks, the 12 peak challenge, you're exceeding 25,000 feet of vertical and just a lot of scrambling and
very little
trail.
So as hard as Crow Pass is, it's kind of like it's a walk in the park compared to this.
Yeah, it's different. Crow Pass, you're doing a lot of running on technical trails, which has its own you know, challenges.
Yeah. So did you set out to do a really good time when you did this? I mean, was that, or were you just trying to finish?
First finish, second time. I think when I started getting interested in it, no one had done it under 24 hours. And Sean Lyons, I believe when he did it, the first one, it was in the 27-hour range. And then it had been done by a couple other guys, Robert DeVessi and Charlie, forgetting his last name. But they did it with a bivy pack and cook stove, and they took like 36 hours, and they did it more as a weekend adventure, which
pretty,
is a great idea,
a pretty
by the way.
Intense one, though. Yeah.
Yeah, an intense one, but you know, at least they stopped and enjoyed their environment. But at that point, no one had done it under 24 hours. So, my first goal in doing it was to do it to finish, and then hopefully go under 24 hours. And myself and a good friend Toby Schwarr, we tried two or three times, and every time the weather didn't cooperate, and we ended up kind of having to shut it down early.
Partway through.
Yeah, we had to discontinue. And so it was humbling, you know, and realized this is something that everything has to really line up for it to be successful.
So what were the weather factors that stopped you?
Well, the first time, believe it or not, it was June. So it seemed like we were headed for really ideal weather window. But it had we had a kind of unusual cold spell in it, and we had termination dust.
Mm-hmm.
Or, we had a snow above about 4,500 feet. So we left early, you know, maybe 3:34 in the morning, and it wasn't until we got up on South Suicide and we realized the top 500 feet or so was just covered in this layer of just sketchy,
super
grimy,
super
treacherous, and we just kind of realized we don't want to. It probably would have melted off within 4 or 5 hours, but you know, that was 4 or 5 hours of pretty exposed kind of scrambling. And so anyways, there was that. There was another day where we had just a high cloud ceiling that was, again, right around that 4,500 foot level. And we tried from the north end that time. We got up on Temptation Peak, and it was this pea soup. And
there's quite a bit of wayfinding in this, too.
There is, yeah. There's a lot of navigating, and some of it's just real kind of on a micro level where, you know, you're just constantly making these decisions whether to stay high, go low, and skirt around something, or go down to a valley and follow the valley floor. And, you know, if you can't see, it's really a deal breaker.
Yeah, yeah, especially because you're trying to run, right?
Right, yeah, or hike fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you finally managed to do it, it was still not, I mean, it sounds like you still had some pretty significant challenges.
Yeah, oh yeah, right. The first time I did it solo, and it was a real bummer because, like I said, my friend Toby and I had trained together, and we had this weather window, and we just had so many times where it didn't work out that, you know, the weather looked great, and unfortunately, at the last minute, Toby had a work commitment come up, but I was so determined to try to take advantage of that weather that I did it, and, you know, I had never been on three or four of the peaks on the north end of the route at that point, because we'd always started from the south, and Toby had scouted these peaks in the north. So without him there, I made some pretty significant route blunders. But I finished it. Ironically, or funnily enough, coincidentally, I was 2 minutes under the record time, not knowing at all. I couldn't remember what
way to
the
go, Harlow.
Was. Yeah,
record holder.
Well, no, I was two. I'm sorry, 2 minutes
two
over.
2 minutes over.
Yeah,
oh,
two
no.
minutes over. Not know. I had
one less drink of water, and you would have waited.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, at that point, it was kind of the last thing on my mind. But it wasn't until later I went and I looked at the old write up from J.T. Lindholm and realized he was 2 minutes faster. Yeah, it was pretty humbling. I made a lot of mistakes, route finding and gear-wise, really, across the board. So,
was that like, in terms of the physical challenges you've done, you've run many races, you've done a lot of stuff. Was this right at the top of what you have accomplished?
I think, yeah, it was up there. You know, there are shorter events where you just leave it all out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the kind of output, the aerobic level, you're more at a, you know, athletes like to use the mm-hmm. level 1, 2, 3, mm-hmm. you know, 4. That was at a higher level of output. But when you just grind for, you know, 22.5 hours in this case.
And this incredible elevation gain.
Yeah, all the climbing. I mean, that was kind of what went on me was the climbing legs. And
yeah,
you do hit the wall, and then you push through and you hit a few walls, and you really have no choice but to finish. You're out there. So, I got into a funny place physically and really mentally, too. The last several hours I was hallucinating and I was dusky. So things are kind of funny looking anyways.
A little bit dangerous.
But you see little tussocks that look like porcupines and things like that. So, yeah, I would say it was effort-wise, it was up there.
So did you go out and do it again with Toby, or was it?
No, so then finally it kind of bothered me that I felt like I'd made so many mistakes. I really wanted to clean those up and hope to do it again with Toby. That never worked, but Matthias Sari
another
friend, another guy that just loved to spend time with in the mountains, we were finally able to do it together, and we had a really fantastic time. But we had a whole nother kind of list of maladies that our route finding was not terrible. I think cleaned up some of the mistakes that I'd made the first time, but we had other foot problems was a big one, you know, where we had some blister issues, and which require a lot of, you know, a lot of maintenance. And we had some dehydration issues where we, you know, had to change her out to get water. It was too dry and on and on. So, you know, the gist of it is it really is a challenge, and there are a whole menu of things that can go wrong. And that's what makes it such a cool thing to try to do.
So you're telling me before we started that some guys have just kind of crushed it recently in terms of taking some time off.
Yeah. So last summer, Lars Arneson and Peter Mamrell, who are, you know, I consider them young bucks. They're in their late 20s and just really, really, really fit guys too. And they went out and they completely crushed it. And, you know, man, all hats off, you know, hats off to these guys. They picked a tremendous route, and they did all the previous people that have done this. No one thought to do what they did, and which Temptation Peak is kind of out there on the, if you're, you know, for those that are familiar with the Front Range, it's kind of on the north end, way out there. And, you know, it's kind of, there's no easy way to tie that in with the rest of the peaks.
Hmm.
But they opted to follow a ridge right off of West Tenaya Peak, straight out to Temptation and back. And I'd looked at that, other people had looked at that and just thought it would be too much scrambling and not worth it, but they went that way, and there turned out to be a really nice worn-in sheep trail that once they got on it, it just gave them a nice route to Temptation and back. So that was,
probably cut a lot of time off.
That cut some time off, there's no doubt. It was brilliant, brilliant route finding. And beyond that, they did this whole thing at a higher level. They chose to do it like they were essentially in a race, and they traveled lighter than anyone else has ever done it. Didn't carry as much food, as much gear, and it worked. They put in a time that I honestly think it's gonna take an amazing effort to top that time.
And what was their time?
It was just over 18 hours.
Uh-huh.
So 4 hours faster than Matthias and I had the previous record, and they were a good 4 hours faster than that.
Well, I mean, this is how sports records get advanced, right? As people figure out new ways to do it, new techniques, you know.
Right.
And sort of like that's a cool thing about this particular challenge is that, like, it's set and then it's got all these different skills that pile into it, right? And so you're
right.
optimizing a bunch of different things, including unbelievable fitness.
Right. No, you, everything has to work, and mm-hmm. and you can be really fit, and but say if you came up from Colorado and said, "Hey, I want to give this thing a try," you're likely to fail dismally just because of all the nuances of the route finding in the Chugach Front Range.
You really need to know our backyard mountains pretty well.
Yeah. You really do.
Yeah, cool. So there, I guess there's a website where these times are posted, right?
Yeah, right.
Who's doing that?
Joe Stock, Joe and Trond Jensen were the first to go under 24 hours, and mm-hmm. and he's an incredibly accomplished mountaineer and adventurer, and he's got a great blog site.
Right.
I don't have the address off the top of my head.
So we'll link that from outdoorexplorer.org, because I know people are going to listen to this and think, oh, I want to do that. And
right.
Not necessarily... No, you know, this is something to be careful about because it's pretty challenging. There's a lot of places you could fall off mountains or have to be rescued if you get totally, you know, get out in the middle of the Front Range and you can't get out.
I'm glad you brought that up because I've talked to numerous people that want to do it, and I just caution everyone that it's risky. There's no doubt. I mean, everyone that lives up here knows what the Chugach rocks are like. I mean, they're loose and they're crumbly, and, you know, there's a ton of exposure.
And people who have died out there, frankly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're right in our Front Range. We've had many, many deaths mm-hmm. over the years, and some of them are just right off flat tops.
So, doesn't mean it has to be technical climbing.
Not at all. No, yeah. And I would guess that most of the bad falls are not technical. They're more mm-hmm. of that you're just trying to make a little move around a kind of a little overhanging rock, and you maybe the hold you have slips out. I always want to caution people to mm-hmm. go if you do want to do this. Talk with people that have done the route. There are a few places that are exposed, and there are almost always some alternate routes around those areas.
Well, and it sounds like the homework is climbing all these 12 peaks individually before you go out to do them together.
Right, and that's part of the fun.
What could be more fun than that?
Oh my goodness,
right?
Yeah. And some of them it takes a lot of work because a good number of those peaks take say if you park at Glen Alps Trailhead, it takes a good 3-4 hours just to get back to mm-hmm. Cocktoya or Willowa. And so, you know, you can make it a summer project or a couple year project, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, Harlow. This has been really fun. It's a great topic. Harlow Robinson, mountain runner, Alaska Sports Hall of Fame director, also Healthy Futures, helping make sure that our kids are staying active. And on this 12 Peak Challenge, we were talking to JT Lindholm earlier. Thanks a lot for coming in, Harlow.
My pleasure.
All right. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. This next segment is from Alaska Public Media's India Alaska series. You'll hear trail runners Matthias Sari and Ellen Brown talking about why they love running in the mountains. If you want to see the video, check out our site at outdoorexplorer.org.
I don't like to run or stationary bike indoors. I've tried on occasion.
Yeah, I think some people are intimidated by mountain or trail running, that it's something that's too difficult. And they gravitate towards the easier surfaces. I find it just really engaging. You can't zone out, you know, or you might find yourself tumbling. You know, no two steps are the same. You're going up, you're going down, you're on technical trail, then it might smooth out. You're constantly changing gears. Your body just sort of takes over, and you see a spot five steps down the way, maybe just this big, and that's where your toe will land in between a bunch of rocks or roots.
And sometimes it's a meditative time for me. It's just always so different. It's like, sometimes it's like a constant foot massage. You know, you're pressing on, little rocks are pressing on all those trigger points on the bottom of your feet.
It's just become a lifestyle. It's not hard to get out the door. It's how I want to spend a couple hours of every day if I can.
Feeling stronger physically made me eventually stronger, I think, mentally. And it's been a wonderful thing for my life. I was always kind of shy and introverted and not very confident. And I think it's really made me into the person I am now, and I'm really appreciative of that. I was on the way up to the 7,000, 6,000 foot peak. I was coming up on a guy, and he said, "Oh, way to go, you're the second woman." And in his next breath, he said, "But that woman in front's a lot younger." But it was one of those things that sort of stuck with me in the back of my mind until the Matanuska Peak race a year later. And I'm at the starting line a year later, and I'm looking around me, looking at the competition, and there weren't any big name women there. And I looked at them all again, and I thought, yeah, boy, they're all younger than me. And I looked again, and I thought, you know, I bet I can beat them all.
I mean, now that I've discovered the mountains, it's definitely, I think, can be a lifelong activity. I'm 42 now, and hopefully when I'm 84, I'll still be doing it. The peak, usually people start dropping off in their late 30s, and I don't know if since I started late I've been able to extend that, or I know the slowdown is coming, but it's still pretty exciting to still be setting my fastest times at Mount Marathon and not having a big drop off in other races into my 40s, so I'm going to ride it as long as I can. Racing is sort of the payoff for getting in really good shape.
I'd like to continue to run into my 70s and possibly 80s. I'd kind of like to do one more Ironman and get one in my 60s. So plenty to look forward to.
There's no bad days in the mountains. It can be pouring rain or 90 degrees.
That was India, Alaska, with runners Matthias Sari and Ellen Brown. For our last segment today, we have a story by a leader in Alaska's history who made a huge contribution to having the trails we use today. Tony Knowles told his story to the Trail Tales event put on by Alaska Trails.
Thank you very much. I was told I have 7 minutes. And it's been a long time since I've done much public speaking, and I noticed none of the other speakers used any notes. So I apologize ahead of time for the delivery, but maybe it's like Mark Twain supposedly said about Wagner's music: it's much better than it sounds. Okay. Okay, you can start the clock now, Steve. Tonight I do want to share some stories about Anchorage trails, and then offer a humble, simple step forward for Alaska's trails. Anyone's image of Anchorage really has to involve trails. Trails are a vital and integral part of our community. Very few other cities in America can have anything that can compare to our over 100 miles of urban Anchorage trails and the several hundred miles of other trails in our neighbor Chugach State Park. The Laney Fleischer Chester Creek Trail, 4 miles from Goose Lake to Westchester Lacoon, was the first paved trail in Anchorage. A group of women advocates led by Laney Fleischer had the vision and incredible persistence to get public support, the city council support, for passing a bond issue. And after that, trails began to blossom. A little over a decade later came the chance to build the Coastal Trail. In the late 1970s, I was on the Anchorage Assembly, and a person I knew, Peter Scholes and Dee Frankfurth, they actually were working for Alaska Center for the Environment at the time, and they insisted on taking me out on a personal tour that could show me out in the mud flats what a great trail it would be. I was out near Fish Creek, and I had the feeling if I didn't agree with them, they were going to leave me there till high tide. So I was hooked. But then the battle began. First of all, with the state, because they had plans already for a Tidewater Freeway. Nice name, bad idea. Then they kind of saw the light. And then next came the railroad. And as a new young mayor, I went to talk to the head of the railroad. He was the Federal Railroad at the time. And he said, "Mr. Mayor, the answer is not no, it's never." And that was his attitude towards mixing people with trains. And but the state then bought the railroad, and that fixed that problem. But then the next problem was the objection of some influential people, such as the legendary Bob Atwood, who at the time was the owner and publisher of the Anchorage Times, which dominated the news media. And he not only was against it, but because the trail would run right by his house, think of the kinds of people that would walk right by his house. But he actually kind of saw the light, and that was okay. So then the next one was the airport, and they don't, if you're not a passenger in the terminal, they don't want you on the airport lands, period. And they just said no. But finally, we actually even got the airport to figure out that it was probably okay. And so, against all odds, but because of the public support, it got built. Now, trails before Anchorage trails have always been a part of Alaska's story, beginning many centuries ago with the indigenous people using trails and rivers for trade and communication. Now, those same ancient trails were then later used by settlers and gold diggers to become the Iditarod and the Klondike Trail. Now is the time that a new vision of trails that would elevate Alaska into a world-class trail destination location. The time has come. This is the time, the place, and the right issue for us to take a humble, simple step forward. The vision is Alaska Long Trails. As a beginning, there would be three Alaska Long Trails. One would be the 900-mile route of the pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez. This brilliant idea of State Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins has already been underway quietly for the last couple of years, and there's a growing measure of public support and progress on the first phase. The second would be a 120-mile trail from the coastal trail in Anchorage to the docks of Stewart. And a third would be a Copper River, 179-mile trail from Glen Allen to Cordova. Now, a futurist could also maybe clearly see a 360-mile link between Fairbanks, where it touches the Taps Line, which is also the Trans-Alaska Trail, and Anchorage. And then a 180-mile link between the same spot in Fairbanks and Glen Allen. That would give us a 900-mile trail with a 500-mile link on one side and a 360-mile leg on the other side. These trails, I believe, would have the critical mass of breathtaking beauty and magnificent wildlife that would far surpass the international trails of Camino del Santiago in Spain, the Inca Trail in Peru, the Pacific Crest Trail and the Appalachian Trail in America, and even the mountain trails in Nepal and Bhutan. the millions of visitors that pay top dollars to experience those trails would have yet another destination location. And these three beginning trails would spur numerous satellite trails off of various access points on the main trail. So what are the benefits of Alaska Long Trails? The hundreds of thousands of independent travelers each year will put our tourism economy at a whole new level. It'll promote healthy lifestyle. It is a sustainable economy. It will become a permanent reason for conservation and environmental protection of our wildlands. The expenses will be dramatically reduced by existing public right-of-way and the very negotiable, but not necessarily for any money, right-of-way all along the pipeline corridor. And finally, the experience and economic benefits open the doors to multiple sources of private and public capital and operational resources. These benefits make ALT doable, but not easy. Taking a page out of Anchorage's own past and how the trail system got built here, we know it must start and finish with a growing swell of grassroots public support. The political and institutional resistance will be considerable, but it can be overcome. And you know where it starts? Right here, tonight, with you. The alt leadership, I call them the four tenors, but actually I can't sing. It's Steve Cleary, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, and Pat Pershow, has already approached Alaska Trails and has the tentative agreement of merging with that organization. You are here tonight because you care about Alaska's trails. If you support all, let's pick up the beat. It begins with neighbors and friends, and then community councils, chambers of commerce, and local government. The legislature needs to know that they should adopt a resolution to encourage the governor to direct his cabinet to begin a feasibility study with Alaska Trails to establish the cost and collaboration of stakeholders. Then our federal delegations need to get their support known to federal agencies. We know the drill. We've done it before, and we've won. There will be no stopping us now. After all, it's just a simple, humble first step forward. Thank you.
That was former Alaska Governor and Anchorage Mayor Tony Knowles at Trail Tales. You can learn more about Alaska Trails and their events at outdoorexplorer.org. Well, that's all for today's show. I want to thank JT Lindholm, who was with us at the beginning talking about the 12 Peak Challenge. We also heard from Aubrey Smith, speaking at Trail Tales, about the Crow Pass Trail. And Harlow Robinson was also with us to talk about the 12 Peak Challenge. The Indy Alaska dug into trail running with Matthias Sari and Ellen Brown. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.